Bhishma Dev lying on his bed of arrows in the battlefield. We heard the ancestry or the lineage from which Bhishma Dev was born. Bhishma Dev being one of the 12 Mahajans, the great authorities throughout all of the history of mankind. Mahajans being those who can discern and set by their example the standard for proper understanding and application in life of the laws of Dharma. We heard that Bhishma Devas was formerly a Vasu, and in this life, one of the principal personalities, 8 Vasus, who serve as military protectors of the whole of the demigod realm, and he was one of them. But because of an offense to Vasishtha, trying to steal the cow of Vasishtha because his wife wanted the cow, Vasishtha cursed him and his other brothers. The other brothers were given the reprieve that just after taking birth on earth, immediately thereafter, they would leave their body, earthly body, and return to their Vasu position. But Dyo would remain on earth. The question came yesterday, if he was cursed, why did he become such a great personality? Because he was a Vasu. And it was even told by Vasishtha, he would, during that long duration of life that he would live on earth, he would be a great hero. And certainly he was. Anyway, so we heard the whole history of his taking birth as Devavrata and his taking a great vow on behalf of his father Santanu. So he became then known as Bhishma, one who has taken a great vow. And the situation of his being involved as a member of the royal family. Well, we didn't so much discuss this, but because he was a member of the royal family, but not as a king, but as a, nonetheless, a member of the royal family, he was maintained as a member of the royal family in royal style. And because by religious principle, he was maintained by the royal family in a situation where there was some military challenge, he was obliged to take the side of the family who was maintaining him. There are other religious principles that he could have opted for, but he opted for that one. And as a result, he fought on behalf of the Kauravas and against the Pandavas, which means he fought against Krishna. And how can Bhishma Dev, a pure devotee of Krishna, fight against Krishna, or Krishna's dearmost devotees, the Pandavas? And we discussed that. His dasya rasa, his rasa of servitorship, was being fulfilled in a different way, in a chivalrous rasa, taking the position of Krishna's enemy, so-called enemy. But actually he wasn't an enemy of Krishna, nor was he an enemy of the Pandavas. He was a devotee of Krishna and a lover of the Pandavas. It's one of these Mahabharat complexities. But there's a rasa issue behind it, or a principle being enacted for the pleasure of Krishna. Then the second day we heard the receiving of the great personalities that came literally from all over the universe, because Bhishma Dev was such an honorable exalted personality. Persons came from all over the universe to be present for his passing, and how he understood, he had the culture to receive them properly. Even he was a little inconvenienced by his lying on the bed of arrows. But because of his graciousness, everyone was fully satisfied with how they were received. And then we heard is he playing owl? No? Sounded like. See you later. One day he'll be able to sit still and not be an owl. Okay. We heard the grief of the Pandavas seeing their grandfather in this condition, and how Bhishma Dev, seeing the grief of the Pandavas, himself began to cry at the pain he saw in their face for their difficulties. And he spoke so beautifully, pacifying the hearts of the Pandavas. He discussed the inexplicable, indiscernible will of the Lord that manifests as the form of time, because time moves events, and as time keeps sagging. As time moves events, things happen. And even if one may be a very pious person, very learned person, exalted person, powerful person, gifted person, even the personality of Godhead, in this case, Bhishma Dev is saying, of course, time is moved by the controller of time. And time, we know from Bhagavad Gita, is Krishna's own energy. So Krishna's in control of time. But seemingly, events take place that through the passage of time or the force of time, no one can understand the reason behind them. And great sages and rishis and learned persons have pondered, and the conclusion is they can't understand in all circumstances the will of the Lord. So when those kinds of events occur, Bhishma Dev's advice was one can look to the way that a person has led their life. Like you Pandavas, you're protected by the Brahmanas, by Dharma, and by the personality of Godhead. Time and again, difficulties came, and you're always protected. So one who lives by those three principles, theistic conduct guided by the Brahmanas and Vaishnavas, and for the purpose of the satisfaction of the Supreme Lord, one will always be protected. The outcome of the events of one's life are not in our hand, they're in the Lord's hand. And the plan of the Lord is not always understandable, but in this case, his desire, Krishna's desire, was that a qualified religious king rule the world. That was Krishna's purpose and descent in coming to this world, and that's what he wanted. So he was telling Yudhisthira, it's now your responsibility. All this has happened by the plan of the Lord. He wants you to be the ruler. All the citizens are waiting. So now perform your duty. And when he finished giving him that instruction, he then started just speaking about the Lord, almost as if speaking to the Lord, and spoke very, very beautifully about his position and how fortunate we are. Here he is. How fortunate I am. And because I'm in this difficult circumstance, He knew that it was my desire that before leaving this body I could see him directly. So he's come before me so that my prayer is I can give up this body seeing the lotus face of the personality of Godhead just before leaving this world. So then here, there's a part that's cut off at the top that says, Lord Krishna inspired Yudhisthira to make this request of Bhishma Dev. So I'm going to read the verse, but Yudhisthira asks Bhishma Dev to speak about, now that you've convinced me, I'm pacified in mind and in my heart, I'm ready to carry out the duties of a king. So please now describe to me the duties of a king. And then there's a whole section, really, really long section thank you. Okay. The picture is smaller, but the script is readable. We're going to hear a short section, 7 days worth of instruction in about 4 verses, of Yudhisthira's, Bhishma Dev's instruction to Yudhisthira. So one thing is, as mentioned, that Krishna wanted to show that amongst learned personalities, one may not be, the most exalted person may not be a Brahmana, because in Bhishma Dev's case, he was a Kshatriya. But the essence is not the ashram or the varna in which one is situated. The qualification is one's depth of understanding of the absolute truth, the conclusion of the scripture, the essence of the means to achieve that conclusion of the scripture. So amongst the rishis present, Bhishma Dev was one of them. So there's the picture. Here's the verse. Maharaj Yudhisthira, after hearing Bhishma Dev speak in that appealing tone, asked him, in the presence of all the great rishis, about the essential principles of various religious duties. Now, the reason for asking that is, it's the duty of the king, in practical manner, to see to it that everyone is engaged in proper activity, suitable to their situation. So that means he not only has to have the power of enforcement, but he has to have the wisdom of what needs to be done in different circumstances. What are different individuals' duties? He needs to know. The brahmanas generally would guide the kshatriyas. In this case, Yudhisthira is a kshatriya, but he's seeking the guidance from Bhishma Dev, not just Vashishta or Gautama or Vyas or Shukadeva Goswami, but Krishna wants to shine the spotlight on Bhishma Dev. So Bhishma Dev answers. At Maharaj Yudhisthira's inquiry, Bhishma Dev first defined all the classifications of castes and orders of life in terms of the individual's qualifications. Then, systematically, in twofold divisions, described counteraction by detachment and interaction by attachment. So it was going along very easy to understand what was being said until that last part. So it's a long purport. It's like 4-page purport. And in the 4 pages, Prabhupada is outlining what Bhishma Dev says in Bhishma Parva. The 4 varnas, Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, 4 ashrams, Brahmachari, Vanaprastha, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, Sannyas. And the duties commonly ascribed to each of those 4 and then 4. So the castes or the occupational work and orders of life. the ashrams. Then let me, I'll read and then I'll do my best to explain this language of counteraction by detachment and interaction by attachment. Here we go. I'll read the whole paragraph. This is the last paragraph of text 26. The varnas are, so to speak, classifications of different occupations, and ashram dharma, because that's what this last sentence is speaking about, ashram dharma, is gradual progress on the path of self-realization. Both are interrelated, and one is dependent on the other. The main purpose of ashram dharma is to awaken knowledge and detachment. The brahmachari ashram is the training ground for the prospective candidates. In this ashram, it is instructed that the material world is not actually the home of the living being. The conditioned souls under material bondage are prisoners of matter, and therefore self-realization is the ultimate aim of life. The whole system of ashram dharma is a means to detachment. One who fails to assimilate this spirit of detachment is allowed to enter into family life with the same spirit of detachment. Therefore, one who attains detachment may at once adopt the fourth order, namely renounced, and thus live on charity alone and not accumulate wealth, but just to keep body and soul together for ultimate realization. Householder life is, in italics, for one who is attached. And the vanaprastha and sannyas orders of life are for those who are detached from material life. The brahmachari ashram is especially meant for training both the attached and the detached. So it goes like this. When a young boy becomes of age to go to school, the parents, classical method, particularly the Brahmana and Kshatriya parents, would place their child in the care of a teacher, a guru. And they would literally go and live in the ashram of the guru. Just like Sudama and Krishna lived in the ashram of the guru. Or Drona and, help me, the Kshatriya, his dear friend, Drupad and Drona. One was a Brahmana, one was a Kshatriya. They went to the same school. They grew up as friends, like Krishna and Sudama. But Krishna was family-wise from a Kshatriya family, and Sudama family-wise was a Brahmana family, but they were dear friends. So the boys would live in the ashram of the guru. And the training of the boys was the same in the beginning. And the training in the beginning, besides the academic training, was the formation of character. Principal responsibility of the teacher was to develop character. And again, I must have heard this in Prabhupada's lectures somewhere between 50 and 100 times. Quoting from the scripture, quoting from the Bhagavatam specifically, that the brahmachari would live as the humble servant of the teacher, and two things. The brahmachari would be taught to see every woman as mother. And the only exception to that is if the boy became married, then he doesn't call his wife mother anymore. That's one person is not his mother. But every other woman is mother. And the second is this, the principle of proprietorship. From a small boy, he would be engaged by the guru, not for the neediness of the guru, but for the training of the small boy. He would go door to door on behalf of the guru, morning and evening, and request some alms. Mataji. So he would go to the door, and he was trained. Everyone is mother. Whether it's a little girl, an old lady, a housewife, everyone is Mataji. Everyone is mother. May I have some alms? An old boy comes to your door and asks for some alms. You give something. So that whatever that something is, he would bring that back and give it to the guru. Because it was, the training was, everything that I receive is the property of the guru. And then the guru would give to his wife, the wife would prepare an offering, make an offering to the deity, and then call the boys to come and take their meal. And consistently, always, Prabhupada would say, and if, because the scripture says, and if the guru would neglect one day to call the boy to come and eat, then he would fast. He wouldn't go and say, I'm hungry. What's to eat? How come you didn't call us? The training was, it's the property. And if the guru of the guru, and if the guru neglects for some reason to call, he'll fast. He's at the mercy of the guru. And that's the training in principle. The guru doesn't forget any more than the wife of the guru will forget the boys are hungry, they should be fed. But it's a principle. So that when the boy grows up, three things. Every woman is mother. Not, here's a possible potential object for me to enjoy. But every woman is mother. That's the training. And all property that I receive is the property of God. I give to Guru, the Guru gives to God, because he's the representative of God. So now I'm an adult, and I have some earnings, and it's the property of my Guru, to be used in the service of God. And I may not put it in the hand of my Guru, but my consciousness is, because this is the way I've been trained, it's the property of Guru, because it's meant for the service of God. And then, the third is, I'm subordinate to the mercy of those who have given me, my parents have given me life, and my teacher who has given me the wisdom of how to lead my life. I'm at their mercy. They're merciful. They're not going to forget. But if they did forget, I'm at their mercy. I accept that as a principle of life. Now, all of that is really beautiful, provided you have qualified teachers. If you have exploiters instead of teachers or unqualified persons, then the whole system falls apart. And the difficulty is then finding or training qualified brahmanas. To train qualified brahmanas, you need qualified brahmanas to train qualified brahmanas. But that's the system. And that Vedic system is what's being described here. So the system is ashram-wise, whether one is, say, Brahmana, Vaishya, or Kshatriya, they would require education. And the education is in the school of the teacher, the guru, and the guru would teach them character and these other principles. Over a period of time, the guru would see, this boy has this propensity. So because he's a qualified guru, he would know how to train a young man for an occupation suited to his propensity. So, varna specific. And then ashram specific. If one was qualified in a brahminical manner and qualified ashram-wise for being detached, then the verse written by Vyasadeva here, is that systematically one would be taught counteraction by detachment. So there's a conditioning influence coming from material nature, counteraction by detachment. But the guru may see, here's one of the students, that detachment isn't so strong in him, he will be more suited for becoming grihastha. And therefore, the principle of occupational training becomes elevated more, and then the specific occupation to suit the boy's nature. Someone may be a kshatriya-spirited person, someone may be a brahmana-spirited person, someone may be a vaishya-spirited person. And then details under those general headings, and the qualified brahmana would train them. Sometimes the qualified brahmana would send them to another qualified brahmana, specifically skilled in some area that he was not skilled in, like to another professor, like that, someone in another department of knowledge. But it was that was the responsibility. The fundamental responsibility was character. And then following that, what would be the ashram? And following that, what would be the varna? So it's not automatically one is this varna or that ashram, but it's by the individual character. And the teacher's duty was to discern character, build the character universally for all, build the principle of detachment universally by all, before all, but some then in course of time would be more qualified this way, some more qualified that way. Counteraction by detachment for those who were inclined for celibate life or brahmachari sannyas life, and interaction by attachment. Still with the foundation, there's interaction, and as a result, there's some attachment, but the principle of dedicating everything that one receives to the guru, dedicating that everything that one receives in adult life to God, like karmani evadikaraste mapaleshu kadachana, from childhood. So they would learn the verse, but not only learn the verse, they'd learn the spirit of the verse. Detachment from the fruits of work is meant for God, but perform your prescribed duty. And then what the prescribed duty is dependent upon the instruction of the guru, which is dependent upon the nature of the child. Somehow this isn't working properly. Okay. So that's what that mystery is. So as it's the duty of Bhishma Dev is describing the duties of a king, so first it's the duty of the brahmana, and the brahmana is to instruct the king in the duties of a king. The king needs to know, okay, what are, according to the different propensities of attachment or detachment, or the particular propensities for work, What are those natures, and what are the duties accordingly? Because the king has to oversee all of that. Then, he explained, by divisions, the acts of charity, the pragmatic activities of a king, and the activities of for salvation. Then he described the duties of women and devotees, both briefly and extensively. So this is a long purport. And one hand, I'd like to read the whole purport. But I'm not sure. We'll read the section on charity because it applies specifically to householders, and many of you are householders. So here's Bhishma Dev's instructions on this point. To give charity is one of the householder's main functions, and he should be prepared to give in charity at least 50% of his hard-earned money. Whoa. A brahmachari or student should perform sacrifices. A householder should give charity. And a person in the retired life or in the renounced order should practice penances and austerities. Those are the general functions for all the ashrams or orders of life on the path of self-realization. I'll go through. In the brahmachari life, the training is sufficiently imparted so that one may understand that the world as property that belongs to the Supreme Lord, the personality of Godhead. No one, therefore, can claim to be the proprietor of anything in the world. Therefore, in the life as a householder, one must give charity for the service of the Lord. Everyone's energy is generated or borrowed from the reservoir of energy, the Lord. Therefore, the resultant actions of such energy must be given to the Lord in the shape of transcendental loving service for Him. Nice. Only it's translated into something that's really easy for children to understand. They go and beg alms. And it's fun. I've seen children do. They take their cloth and extend their cloth. A little cute kid comes to the door and says, "Can I have some alms from my teacher?" And the housewife smiles and, "Sure, I'll give you something." And the boy is, so he's looking, he's got all this stuff. All he had to do is put out his cloth and say, "Can I have some alms from my teacher?" And there it is. So what does he do with that which he receives? It goes to the teacher. The teacher gives to his wife, and the wife prepares some ingredients. Because it's not just they get money, they get some grains or some attar or something. And that goes to the wife of the guru, and she prepares, and it's offered to the Lord, and now it's prasad, because it's the property of the Lord. It's just changing from this hand to that hand to that hand to the Lord. That's life. Now I'm an adult. I receive something from my occupational work. It's the property of God. Like, same, just part of the culture from childhood. As the rivers draw water from the sea to the clouds and again go down to the sea, similarly our energy is borrowed from the Supreme Source, the Lord's energy, and it must return to the Lord. That is the perfection of our energy. The Lord, therefore, in Bhagavad Gita says that whatever we do, whatever we eat, etc., must be offered to Him. That is the way of utilizing our borrowed energy. When our energy is utilized in that way, our energy is purified from the contamination of material inebrieties, and thus we become fit for our original, natural life of service to the Lord. Now, Prabhupada did that in a different way, but the same principle. The principle was book distribution. So it was his life, his work, the Bhaktivedanta purports. Sometimes Prabhupada called it, at least in American culture, we didn't understand this so much, but grew to understand it. He called it a family business. In India, you know what that means. It was our spiritual master's life. At least I can say from my perspective, it was something that Prabhupada wanted to give to the world, these teachings of Lord Chaitanya. And we were just to assist him and give the teachings of Lord Chaitanya through his Bhaktivedanta purports. And our life was going door to door. Instead of saying, can you give some alms? It was, please take one of these books. And when people gave something for those books, it was the property of our spiritual master. It was really, you know, the math was really easy. It came from him, it belongs to him. And my necessities are taken care of. My 6 foot of space, a sleeping bag lying on the floor, and a couple dhotis, and, you know, some prasadam, distributing books on behalf of Srila Prabhupada. It was simple. It was happy. It was joyful. It was pleasing to him. It was all his property. He could do with it what he liked, but what he liked was to give Krishna consciousness to other people. I was sharing this with someone just today. It's a simple thing. A formula for the printing of Prabhupada's books. He had a formula. It was the doublet formula. The formula was there was a certain cost involved in book production, like, you know, the team that took the recorded Bhaktivedanta purports and transcribed it and got it all ready for the press. And then the press, the printing costs, the paper costs, the color separations for the color plates and the binding and the, you know, everything, and the shipping cost. So there's some cost. BBT price. So then the formula was double the price, and then the BBT should take back whatever they received that, you know, the half of the doubled price for printing more books. And the more books they would print, the more books they could print. And so that's, and then the other half was, he called it construction fund for building temples. He called the BBT his blood. That was like, you know, the heart was beating and circulating blood through the body of ISKCON so that the International Society for Krishna Consciousness could expand directly to the temples, that then they received the books and they would mark up the price of the book double. So they would have, they could give back to the book fund what they paid for the book, and they would then have money for maintaining themselves and expanding, building a temple or whatever they wanted to do. I don't know if any of you have been to the ISKCON Tirupati temple. Has anyone been there? Are you aware that it was built entirely from book distribution? Not from contributions of congregation members to build the temple, but from book distribution. I don't know of any other temple in ISKCON that has done like that. So all credit to Revati Raman, the temple president there. He did so largely by his own quality, became very much, he was very much appreciated by the TTD personalities, and because of that, they gave him places for the devotees to sell Prabhupada's books, like stalls at some of the main junctures in the whole of Tirupati. And from that, he received funds, and with that, he built the temple. And he was so, his doing of that was done so nicely, and how the devotees were interacting with the public was done for years so nicely. The TTD members said, now that you've built your nice temple, can you help us? We have this Luglu distribution that we've been doing for years, and we have 30 stalls throughout the place, but maybe your brahmacharis could take that over. Did you know that? So he said, sure, you've helped us. We would be very happy to help you. I mean, it's not exactly the language that he used, but that was the mood. And the brahmacharis received the luglus that are made by the Tirupati organization, and all the money goes back to the Tirupati organization. And Revati Raman described that they used to have 30 stalls, now they have 15, and it's going to go down to 10. Because he just, you know, he's so such a good organizer. And all the money goes to Balaji. And there are, you know, whatever it is that they need to do. So there's such a nice relationship between the two entities, ISKCON and TTD. There's more, but it was built on book distribution. And largely, that's how ISKCON grew, through book distribution, the family business. And the training of the brahmacharis was, as I just described, everything belongs to our spiritual master. And that's nice. Then, you know, that's brahmachari life. And then at some point, some brahmacharis, many brahmacharis, many young men, wished to become married, and they became married. And, you know, then there's that whole history. They weren't really ready to take up an occupation in household or life because they had just lived their life as brahmacharis because we didn't have the system of the guru teaching them interaction by attachment. So there was a little hiccup in our social structure for a bit, how to have brahmacharis move from brahmachari to household life. That's getting a little better organized these days. Still, it needs some work. Then, following this point of charity, there's a whole section on Raja Dharma. The pious kings were not merciful to dacoits and thieves in the name of nonsensical ahimsa. The thieves and dacoits were punished in an exemplary way so that in the future no one would dare commit such nuisances in an organized form. Such thieves and dacoits were never meant for administration as they are now. The taxation law was simple. There was no force, no encroachment. The king had the right to take one-fourth of the production made by the subject. The king had a right to claim a fourth of one's allotted wealth. One would never grudge in parting with it because, due to the pious king and religious harmony, there was enough natural wealth, namely grains, fruits, flowers, silk, cotton, milk, jewels, minerals, etc. And therefore, no one was materially unhappy. The citizens were rich in agriculture and animal husbandry, and therefore they had enough grains, fruits, and milk without any artificial needs of soaps and toilets, cinemas and bars. The king had to see that the reserve energy of humanity was properly utilized. Human energy is meant not exactly for fulfilling animal propensities, but for self-realization. The whole government was specifically designed to fulfill this particular purpose. As such, the king had to select properly the cabinet ministers, but not on the strength of voting background. The ministers, the military commanders, and even the ordinary soldiers were all selected by personal qualification, and the king had to supervise them properly before they were appointed to their respective posts. He's going through Rajadharma, the duties of a king. The king was especially vigilant to see that the tapasvis, or persons sacrificing everything for disseminating spiritual knowledge, were never disregarded. In italics, Prabhupada writes, "The king knew very well that the Supreme Personality of Godhead never tolerates any insult to his unalloyed devotees." Such tapasvis, or devotees, were trusted leaders, even of the rogues and thieves, who would never disobey the orders of tapasvis. Like, what's the name of the dacoit who stopped Narada and wanted to rob him? No. It just wanted to rob him. In Ramayana, in the beginning. What's his name? Something like that. And Narada said, you know, who's going to take responsibility for your impious activities, for your sinful activities? You think your family is going to accept the responsibility? Oh, sure. I'm working for them. Why don't you go and ask them if they'll accept? No, this is just a trick. You're trying to escape. No, we're saints. We'll stay here. We're truthful. We'll just sit here under the tree. And he came back and he was shocked. They said, no, we're not going to take those sinful reactions for all of your robbing. Said, see? Now what are you going to do? Well, I don't know. What should I do? you should chant the name of the Lord, Rama. It wouldn't come out. It was too sinful. So chant it backwards, Mara. So what was his name? No, later he became Valmiki, but before he was Valmiki. Yeah. So even the dacoits would see the sadhu respectfully, like Magari saw Narada respectfully. Even Kamsa saw Narada respectfully. Jarasandha saw the Brahmanas respectfully. But because Vedic culture was so strong, now who respects some? Anyway, so everything has become very degraded. So the verse is respect for Brahminical culture. It's throughout the whole of the first canto, again and again and again. The essential cultural ingredient of respect for Brahminical culture, and then having qualified Brahmanas, not just someone that has a two-paisa thread, but qualified persons, qualified by character, truly qualified. And then those persons can guide the Brahmanas, or the Kshatriyas, and the Kshatriyas can lead the rest of society. As far as salvation is concerned, one has to conquer the principles of lust, anger, unlawful desires, avarice, and bewilderment. You know, the six enemies. Kam, krodh, lobh, moha, mada, matsarja. What do you do? Here's the instructions. Listen, I'll read slowly. To get freedom from anger, one should learn how to forgive. To be free from unlawful desires, one should not make plans. By spiritual culture, one is able to conquer sleep. By tolerance only can one conquer desires and avarice. Disturbances from various diseases can be avoided by regulated diets. By self-control, one can be free from false hopes. And money can be saved by avoiding undesirable association. By practice of yoga, one can control hunger. And worldliness can be avoided by culturing the knowledge of impermanence. Dizziness can be conquered by rising up. And false arguments can be conquered by factual ascertainment. Talkativeness can be avoided by gravity and silence. And by prowess, one can avoid fearfulness. Perfect knowledge can be obtained by self-cultivation. One must be free from lust, avarice, anger, dreaming, etc., to actually attain the path of salvation. So this is not paradharma. Therefore it's not elaborately discussed in the Bhagavatam, because the Bhagavatam subject is paradharma. But these dharmic principles, they assist to bring one to the point of salvation. And so they're mentioned. As far as the women class are concerned, they are accepted as a power of inspiration for men. As such, women are more powerful than men. Yay! From the women's side. Boo! From the men's side. No. Mighty Julius Caesar was controlled by a Cleopatra. Such powerful women are controlled by shyness. Therefore, shyness is important for women. Once this control valve is loosened, women can create havoc in society by adultery. Adultery means production of unwanted children, known as varna sankara, who disturb the world. The last item, taught by Bhishma Dev, was the process of pleasing the Lord. We are all eternal servants of the Lord, and when we forget this essential part of our nature, we are put into material conditions of life. The simple process of pleasing the Lord, parentheses for householders especially, is to install the deity of the Lord at our home. By concentrating on the deity, one may progressively go on with the daily routine work, worshiping the deity at home, serving the devotee, hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam, residing in a holy place and chanting the holy name of the Lord are all inexpensive items by which one can please the Lord. Thus, the subject matter was explained by the grandfather to his grandchildren. Nice. 7 days summarized very briefly. So as it says, you know, in summary and in detail. So here is summary. And then Bhishma's instructions are found in detail. So the comments here, there's even a closer up picture. Very beautiful painting, huh? Krishna wanted to prove, this is Prabhupada's purport, Krishna wanted to prove that impure devotees are always sound in body and mind by dint of spiritual enlightenment, and thus in any circumstances the devotee of the Lord is in perfect order to speak the right way of life. I included Prabhupada's picture here because Prabhupada enacted the same pastime. We mentioned this the first day, second day, again. For those of you that don't know from Prabhupada's life, he had, in his adult life, he had a couple of very serious diseases. I didn't know about it until, like, much later, till after he had departed. But those that were working closely with him knew of those difficulties. He had a kidney problem, and he had some other circulatory problems, and they were very painful. Hari Sori told me that even he was in so much pain, Prabhupada would carry on as if there was nothing going on. He told me the story once that Prabhupada had an abscess. You know what an abscess is? Like an infection in the gum of your tooth. And the jaw swells out like that. Abscess. So they wanted Prabhupada to go to a dentist. And he was saying, no, I won't go to a dentist. Just give me some cloves. So he would put cloves, because that cloves has a quality that it's like Novocaine. You know, it numbs. You don't feel the pain. So his jaw was just like puffed out. And then he was carrying on like there wasn't anything at all. You know what it's like to get a toothache. Oh. But no groaning, and he didn't change his behavior at all. Then one day he was taking prasadam and he reached in his mouth and pulled out the tooth and handed it to Hari Sori. Said, you can keep this. He just went on with his meal. That was going to the dentist. And one of the practices that Prabhupada kept, in part because of his age, but largely because of the kidney failure, one kidney didn't work at all, the other was working half, which meant that uric acid was going throughout his body, wasn't being eliminated. And so, to help stimulate the circulation of the body and otherwise eliminate the toxins within his body, he had massage. And Prabhupada just carried on like nothing was wrong other than he was receiving a massage. He said twice Prabhupada was unable to do his service because the pain was overwhelmingly severe. He said one night at 12:30, the buzzer rang because Prabhupada had a system at his desk. Underneath the desk was a little buzzer, so he couldn't even see it. He just reached under the desk, pressed the buzzer, and that sent a signal to where his servant was, and the servant was to come and see what his need was. He said it was, Prabhupada had his chadar wrapped around his body and over his head, and his whole body was shivering. Not because of the cold, because of the pain. And he said, Prabhupada said in a trembling voice, I'm in so much pain, I can't do my translation. And that happened twice. Otherwise, he just went on. And as his body became afflicted again, without going into detail, it's in the Lilamrita, he went to the UK, he had to have an operation in the UK, and then he went back to India. He was on his way coming to America to do another world tour when his body was so emaciated. He went back, and he decided to give up his body, something like Bhishma having the benediction from Santanu. He could stay in his body or give up his body. So Prabhupada was in this position where he could stay or he could go. He was demonstrating it. And he was not, although his body was certainly racked with pain, like I was just, I Rupa Sanatan shaved my head today. So we were spending some time, and I was, you know, just asking him, describe what's going on with your body, and he was saying what was going on with his body, and, you know, in this place over here in the middle of his back, it feels like there's a knife sticking in his back. And then there's another one that's kind of, and he was describing, you know, what was going on. And it's not the same, but it's very similar to an experience with Bhakti Tirtha Swami, where I went to visit him when I knew he had terminal cancer, a very virile kind of cancer. And when I went in, he was lying down, and his servant Ekavir was attending to his needs. And like this, Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj was rubbing his shoulder. And as soon as I came in, he lit up like a Christmas tree. He just like smiled and really happy. And then in the course of the conversation, he said what was going on with his body. And he said, right here, my hand is raised because about the size of a softball is a tumor right here in my, pressing against my collarbone. And then there's another one over here, and there's another one over there, and there's another one over there. And he just smiled like, you know, he wasn't on pain medication, he was just enduring the pain. But I thought, you know, the visit was going to be this very painful, tearful thing, just seeing him in this condition. But he was so ecstatic. And it wasn't an exchange, it was a monologue. He was just going on and 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 on about what he said afterwards was, each time someone comes to see him, he just prays to Krishna, how can I be of service to this devotee? And he knows that I've done some creative outreach, so he was giving some ideas of creative outreach that he's done to reach different audiences, and how he went about it, and what his contemplations were, and just sharing. And it was so enlivening for him that he just went on and on and on. Although he hadn't slept at all that night because he was in so much pain. I thought it was going to be a real short meeting, but it was a real long one. Like that, Prabhupada showed all of the devotees, because previously the arrangement was for our own protection. Only there was a distance between ourselves and our spiritual master, because when there's intimacy, when there's close dealings with someone, there can be familiarity. And he taught us familiarity breeds contempt. It doesn't have to result in contempt, but it's the breeding ground for contempt. Just like a very practical example is deity worship. We worship the deity from a distance. And those that worship the deity up close, they have to have very special qualification. That's They must be brahmanas to worship the deity on our altars in the temples. And ideally it should be in someone's home also. So the reason for that is to be intimately connected. There has to be purity and freedom from that tendency to be contemptuous towards that which, when we get close to someone, we know all their shortcomings. They know all our shortcomings. And so there's, in that closeness, just like in marriages or in families or when communities come close to one another, you come to know what all the weaknesses and shortcomings and, you know, those kinds of things are with one another. And then how does your mind process that? You can become contemptuous towards them. Therefore, as with deity worship, the deity is at some distance. So Prabhupada always had us keep some distance. You know, the spiritual master sits on an elevated seat. And one sits at some distance from the spiritual master and pays respects and obeisances. During this time, when Prabhupada was leaving, all of that distance and formality was withdrawn. And he was lying on his bed, and the room was commonly filled with devotees. And there was soft kirtan, because Prabhupada was resting. But he wasn't like, okay, now he's resting, leave the room. It was soft kirtan, he's resting. And chanting japa. He was freely allowing persons to have, I wasn't there, I was the president of the New York City Temple, so I stayed back while many devotees went. But massaging his body and, you know, just being intimately associating with him in that way was, in one sense it was ecstatic, in another sense it was heartbreaking. But it was like that with seeing Grandfather Bhishma in that condition. And more or less, Prabhupada let the devotees know that Krishna is allowing me to stay or to go. He's giving me that choice. And then he looked at his body and said, it's useless. Should just give it up. No, don't give it up. So that back and forth interaction with him, similar to how the Pandavas were feeling. So Krishna wanted to show this feature of a very, very exalted personality like Bhishma Dev. They're in full control of their mind and senses. It doesn't mean the body shall be eternal, but they're protected in that way. Full control of their mind and senses. Fully prepared to carry out the will of Krishna, even in a most uncomfortable, difficult situation. So, go a little bit further. Thus, Bhishma Dev described the occupational duties of different orders and statuses of life, citing instances from history, for he was himself well acquainted with the truth. While Bhishma Dev was describing occupational duties, the sun's course ran into the northern hemisphere. This period is described by mystics who die at their will. So you know what that is, Makara Sankranti. The sun, according to Vedic astronomy, and from Western astronomy, the sun moves in relation to the earth from the northern hemisphere in the summer solstice, it moves in a southerly direction. And it crosses the equator where the days and nights are equal, called the equinox. And then it continues to move in a southerly direction till, in relation to the northern hemisphere, it reaches its apex at the bottom. The winter solstice, the longest night and the shortest day. And then the sun starts moving in a northerly direction. And it crosses the hemisphere and day or night are equal. And then the days become longer than nights and become summer solstice. like that in the course of 1 year. The sun moves in relation to the earth. So when, according to Bhagavad Gita and the rest of the Vedas, when a yogi leaves his body as the sun is moving in the northerly direction, the soul, the destination of the soul is liberation. Stated directly in Bhagavad Gita. So Bhishma Dev was waiting for that auspicious moment, although because he was fully Krishna conscious, he could have left this world at any time. But he chose to wait until that time, after thoroughly instructing Yudhisthira and having the Lord directly in front of him. Thereupon, that man who spoke on different subjects with thousands of meanings and who fought on thousands of battlefields and protected thousands of men stopped speaking and became completely freed from all bondage, withdrew his mind from everything else, and fixed his wide open eyes upon the original personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, who stood before him, four-handed, dressed in yellow garments that glittered and shined. Purport. In the momentous hour of leaving his material body, Bhishma Dev set the glorious example concerning the important functions of human form of life. The subject matter which attracts the dying man becomes the beginning of his next life. In italics. Or yam yam vapi smaran bhavam chajatante kalevaram. Whatever the mind is fixed upon at the time of death, that state one will attain without fail. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. So where does the mind go at the time of death? The mind goes to that which you're most attached to. Commonly, it's described for people that have near-death experiences. The ones that have that die, they can't come back and tell you what it was like. But near-death experiences, people say, the events of their life flash by very, very quickly. Zoom, 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 like a high-speed movie. And those things that are most important to one, prominent, where your attachments are, that's where the mind goes most significantly. And at that moment, when the mind is fixed like that, soul leaves the body, and that's going to determine the destination of the soul, what the mind is fixed upon. It's not an accident. It's the cultivate, what you have cultivated in the course of your life, what you have become attached to in the course of your life. Largely, we've been discussing, people are attached to fruit of activity. Not only the economic development kind, but, you know, all varieties of thinking of oneself as the doer, as the cause of the result of your action and being attached to the results of your action and trying to be the enjoyer of that which one feels one is entitled to. I created the result of the action. It's mine. I'm entitled to enjoy it. And whether it's religious activity or economic activity or family, whatever it is, whatever the arena of one's what one does, trying to be the enjoyer of that is common. It's like pervasive. So Bhagavad Gita is teaching us again and again, and the Bhagavatam, by the example of Bhishma Dev, is teaching us explicitly how to become attached to the Supreme. Because if you become in this life practiced not just to do good work so that you'll get elevation to a heavenly planet, but you attach your consciousness to the Supreme. You work for Krishna. You do, just as Prabhupada quoted the verse, yad karoshi, yad asnasi, yad jahosi, that, whatever it is that you do, your work, your austerities, your charity, do that for the Supreme. With attachment for the Supreme. Develop attachment for the Supreme. Because then the mind will go to the Supreme. And when the mind goes to the Supreme, you go to the Supreme. But that's not going to happen if there's not practice now. It's very obvious, very reasonable. Not just cultivating a behavior, but attachment to something or someone. And if we're not attached to the Supreme, we'll be attached to one of the energies of the Supreme, commonly in the mood of being the enjoyer of that energy, and therefore we're attached to that. The teaching, once again, is to transfer not of, I don't care about this person or that thing or this situation or the world or life. The caring becomes transferred to in relation to the Supreme. That's the art. That's the message of transcendence. And then that's where the soul will go. Therefore, if one is absorbed in thoughts of the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna, he is sure to go back to Godhead without any doubt. And then Prabhupada just gives the translation of the verses from the 8th chapter. I'm going to read them and it will end here. Text number 5 from chapter 8 goes through text 15. And whoever at the time of death quits his body remembering me alone at once attains my nature, of this there is no doubt. Whatever state of being one remembers when he quits his body, that state he will attain without fail. Therefore, Arjuna, you should always think of me in the form of Krishna. At the same time, carry out your prescribed duty of fighting with your activities dedicated to me and your mind and intelligence fixed on me. You will attain me without a doubt. He who meditates on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, his mind engaged in remembering me, undeviated from this path, he, O Arjuna, is sure to reach me. One should meditate upon the Supreme Person as one who knows everything, as he who is the oldest, who is the controller, who is smaller than the smallest, who is the maintainer of everything, who is beyond all material conception, who is inconceivable, and who is always a person. He is luminous like the sun, and being transcendental is beyond this material nature. One who, at the time of death, fixes his life air between the eyebrows and in full devotion engages himself in remembering the Supreme Lord, will certainly attain the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Persons learned in the Vedas, who utter Omkara, and who are great sages in the renounced order, enter into Brahman. Desiring such perfection, one practices celibacy. I shall now explain to you this process by which one may attain salvation. The yogic system, text 12, the yogic situation is that of detachment from all sensual engagements, closing all the doors of the senses and fixing the mind on the heart and the life air at the top of the head. One establishes himself in yoga. After being situated in this yogic practice and vibrating the sacred syllable Om, the supreme combination of letters, if one thinks of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and quits his body, he will certainly reach the spiritual planets. Two more. For one who remembers me without deviation, I am easy to obtain, O son of Pritha, because of his constant engagement in devotional service. After attaining me, the great souls who are yogis in devotion never return to this temporary world, which is full of miseries, because they have attained the highest perfection. Then Prabhupada comments how this applies to Bhishma Dev. So he did all these things. Krishna was completely, he was doing some service in a very difficult situation. But he was asked to do some service by Yudhisthira. So he did the service. He gave a long dissertation on the duties of a king, how government should be organized and how the people should be guided. He did all of that. And then the sun moved. So now he's going to let go of this body, and in so doing he's withdrawing his senses from external activity, the service that he's been doing for so many years. He has the capacity to do that. Extend the senses for service, withdraw the senses otherwise, and fix his mind completely upon Krishna. He therefore fixed his open eyes upon him. He wanted to see Krishna for a long time out of his spontaneous love for him. Because he was a pure devotee, he had very little to do with the detailed performance of yogic principles. Simply bhakti yoga is enough to bring about perfection. Therefore, the ardent desire of Bhishma Dev was to see the person of Lord Krishna, the most lovable object. And by the grace of the Lord Sri Bhishma Dev, had this opportunity at the last stage of his breathing. So he's going to now go through another set of verses where he's speaking his inner meditation on Krishna. Not just what he sees, but his mood of love for Krishna. And they're very, very beautiful verses, and that's tomorrow. Stay tuned for the next installment. Any discussion or questions? Yes?
Guru Maharaj, in the modern education system, we spend years on training for vocational.
Years. Count the number of hours.
And it seems in the Vedic system there's very little time spent on that.
It depends on the propensity. Just because this is something I've become a little bit familiar with of late, there are amongst the brahmanas, there are those that specialize in different things. For example, some brahmanas specialize in cosmology. So for the temple of Vedic Planetarium, our devotees went to visit some members of the Sri Sampradaya and the Madhva Sampradaya that have their whole team that, boy, they're absorbed. And for generations and generations and generations, they pass on that wisdom. And it's not like, you know, something they do on the side. They're absorbed. Absorbed. And for that matter, you know, say dance. Classical dance or classical music or you just, the depth is oceanic. You just keep going and going and going and going and going and going and you can't find the bottom and keep going and going. The detail is so refined. So it depends on one's propensity. And then to go to that depth, one has to find someone who can take you there. Who has similar propensity and fully fixed in their mind and senses and devotion to the Supreme Lord, and then they can take you there. But the purpose is glorification of the Supreme Lord. It's not mastering something so that I can earn some money. The motivation today is not knowledge. The motivation today is something else. You know, so, 'cause culture is lost and spiritual value is manda. You have something else?
Yeah, I was wanting to hear more, Maharaj, about. I have faith that through hearing and chanting, all character development can come. I was just wondering if you would comment some of.
Well, along with hearing and chanting is who one is hearing from, or with any kind of Vedic wisdom or knowledge, there's a teacher, and the relationship with the teacher is of fundamental importance. Not just, like, you know, not only you can't remember all of what you learned, but, you know, what was the name of your third grade teacher, or your fifth grade teacher, or your science teacher? You know, our students today will be able to tell you what their teacher's name is, but when they're, you know, they're not going to remember. Maybe there was somebody somewhere along the way that particularly moved the heart of someone. You know, like, they connected very much to the heart of someone. And that person's name you may remember. But there's not an ongoing relationship with that person. It's a memory, at best. But, you know, the one that you remember is where there was some value in life. Not just some information, but some value in life. I can remember my eighth grade science teacher's name, but, you know, I can't remember too many other names. My third grade teacher. But the Vedic culture is that the teacher would stay with the student for their whole life because they were qualified to not just teach, you know, second grade math and then third grade algebra or whatever it is. You know, they're oceanic. Their wisdom. And then, so, that the relationship with that teacher was very, very, very important in gaining knowledge. So it's just like this hearing and chanting question you asked. It's not the mechanical hearing and chanting. It's the relationship with the person from whom you're hearing and the qualification of the person from whom you're hearing and the relationship that flows because of that and one's eagerness to receive. Then the hearing and chanting process is very effective. But supposing I don't know how to have a relationship, supposing that's the situation, right? You know, to help something. The hearing and chanting is going to have effect anyway. So the most unqualified victim of Kali Yuga, Janata Agha, in the language of the Bhagavatam, persons who are just victimized by the cruel and sinful propensities of this age of Kali, just by being exposed to the process of hearing and chanting, they're becoming purified. It's good for the gentle and the ruffians alike. But the continuing further in the process of the full effect to come from hearing and chanting process requires very strong relationship with persons who are qualified, who can, just as in the language of Bhagavad Gita, one can, the tattva-darshi can impart knowledge unto someone because they have seen the truth. But they can impart knowledge unto someone who is eager to receive and qualified to receive. So that's going further with the process of hearing and chanting. I'm thinking a little bit now of the discussion from the morning's Bhagavatam verse about Dhruva Maharaj. And Dhruva's, although he had big time material desire, he didn't just want, you know, have the last word. He wanted a kingdom. He didn't want just his father's kingdom. He wanted his father's 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 kingdom, better kingdom. So he was like, you know, strong material desire, but he was also qualified by his determination to obey Narada, follow the instructions of Narada, and achieve Lord Vishnu. So his practice was very effective. Even it was starting in the mixed position, it moved to the unmixed position. And in our present, that the Bhagavatam's recommendation, specifically the recommendation for this age, is Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu, hearing and chanting about Vishnu, the personality of Godhead, because all potencies are there. Nijasarva Shaktis. And then everything becomes revealed, including character. All good things. From attachment to Krishna, all good things, all good qualifications come. Become attached to Krishna. Yes.
Maharaj, whatever the king does, activities like pious and impious activities, so it goes, some part of it goes to the citizen of the country, right?
The king's piety and impiety goes to the citizens.
The activities, yeah.
Yes.
Similarly,
1/6, it says in the scripture.
Some part of, some percentage.
1/6.
1/6. So I was similarly, but practically, I was bringing that same thing to the Grahastha Ashram, keeping man as the head of the family. Could you please comment on that part of how does that work in a Grahastha Ashram, in a family or...
Well, it's not specific to piety versus impiety, but it's specific to the role in Vedic culture. Again and again, Prabhupada would speak about this or write about this, that the role of the husband is to engage himself in religious activity, and by his doing so, that would give merit, and the merit would give protection to the family. And the duty of the wife was to assist the husband in his service of bringing merit to the family. Of course, performing occupational duty, but bringing spiritual merit to the family. And that the wife would assist the husband in those activities. Now, depending upon Brahmana, Kshatriya, or Vaishya, what that merit would look like, how it would manifest, would be different according to their occupation. But the principle is bringing merit to the family. And the wife assisting in those activities. When the husband becomes qualified like that, it becomes very easy for the wife to follow. And that's the natural situation where the husband is leading and the wife is following. But for that to take place, the husband has to be engaged in that way. And it's part of his duty. And then when the husband and wife, when the father and the mother are engaged in that way, children see, oh, this is what we do when we grow up. We do like this. There's the model. And they can emulate, of course, follow in their own way, but here's the standard, here's what it looks like. And I feel protected and safe, and then grow in that atmosphere. Someone else? Yes.
In today's class, you explained about like the ancient time, like how the Gurukul system was.
Yes.
It was very wonderful to know how the kids, their mentality was. They have to take on, that way they knew that they were responsible for the, like, it's the property of God and it has to be utilized in a better way.
Yes.
So, versus the modern society, like the life we are living now, half the time the kids don't even ask, like, we don't even give them the chance to, like, whatever they need be provided to them, and we also encourage them, like, least like as a parent, we tell them, do not like take or accept things from others.
Yeah, morality.
So,
moral instruction from the family.
But what's the? Are we teaching them something wrong, Maharaj? Like as a parent?
It's limited. It's not wrong to teach morality, but it's limited. What's the basis and support for that? Because later on, they'll be challenged. Why not do this? And the answer is, well, mommy taught me to do something else, not to do this. Well, you know, what kind of reason, why did mommy tell you to do that? I don't know. Oh, come on, don't be a mommy's boy. And etc. So if without knowing the, without having the basis and support, moralities change. Today's morality is yesterday's immorality. You know, without going too far with that explanation. So what's the basis? So what's important is, as parents, what's the basis of don't take others' property? It's the basis we just read is the property of God. Not just it's somebody else's property. They worked hard, they earned it, it's theirs, so don't take the hard-earned property of someone else. But ultimately, that hard-earned property came from the energy of God, and it's the energy of the property of God. And it's allotted to them by God. So don't take someone else's quota. Isavas shamidam sarvam. So the scriptural principle is there, and then how to live according to scriptural principle. And when that consciousness is carried, when Krishna consciousness, not just morality, but when the basis and support of morality is in the consciousness of the parent, that's what gets passed on to the child. And that's what sticks. There's the scriptural basis for the morality, and there's the practical experience. This is how it feels. This is what it looks like. This is what it is. The realization. It doesn't, besides, you know, the gut feeling that something that's, you know, taking someone else's property is a crime and it's an immorality. It just doesn't feel right. Besides, mommy said, you know, don't take someone else's property. So your question is, are we not doing the wrong thing? It's doing the right thing, but keep going. What's needed, you can pass on what you've received. You can't pass on something you don't have. You can't give to somebody else something you don't have. So the main duty of parents is to go deeply into the experience of Krishna consciousness, the experience of seeing things in relation to Krishna, seeing my life in relation to Krishna, seeing my family, seeing my possessions, seeing everything in relation to Krishna. And it doesn't come about just by reading a book or snapping your fingers or saying, okay, I got figured that one out, what's next? It's not an academic event, it's a devotional experience through purification. And many of you, the fact that you're practicing Krishna consciousness so carefully, so diligently. I mean, here we are at 9 o'clock at night on a weekday, you know, three nights a week. Then the Friday's okay because you don't have to go to work tomorrow, but that you're here hearing very carefully. To me, that says, you know, you're committed. It may not be that from childhood you received those things. You received morality most likely, otherwise, commonly, you wouldn't be here. You'd be somewhere else doing something else. So the morality is there, and now to go more deeply into the paradharma reality, the spiritual reality, there's some attraction for doing that. And as you do that, that you can pass on. And then it becomes more than just, you know, a moral teaching that your dependents learn you don't take the property of others, etc. there's the feeling, the deeper sense of relationship with the personality of God. And I can't deviate from Him, from the codes that I should live my life by, because they're given by Him. I'm bound by that. I'm bound by love, not just by law.
Yeah. The guru and all, but like right now, like they live with the parents.
Yeah.
And then, as I said, like they took alms, they got home alms, and then they cooked the food. But like vice versa, like we cook and we give it to them. I, as a parent, like what I do is like I tell her, like if you like somebody's food, let me know. I can make it prasad and I can give it to you. Do not take it from other people. The other hand, you can distribute prasad, so I encourage her to
That's
stay
nice.
With her friends.
Nice.
And then I tell her, like, you can do some services in the temple. Like, whatever she's able or she's capable of doing, I encourage her to. I tell her, you can do it, and she does it. Like, what more as a parent can we teach them so that they get the qualities, like, when they grow up, so they can be in the right path?
Well, that's a big question. It's a big package. It's the whole package. One of the things that, because what's been presented in these purports is principles. So, in addition to in the temple, not in place of in the temple, but in addition to the in the temple, you have, just as here, they have a deity in their home. And do something together as a family, in relation to the deity in the home, and have your daughter take some role. You change the water and you offer a flower and something. And not just, oh, you know, I gotta do it. But it's part, you know, because it's part of, and then, you know, explain the why we do this and why we don't do that, why it must be clean. And it's very, you know, just, because it's inside your heart, you'll pass it on. So the message that I'm sharing is more important than the details of what you do with your daughter, is what you're carrying inside your heart. Then the what to do becomes natural. Receive first. Go as deeply as you can and continue to go deeply. You'll get deeper and deeper in the spirit of the message, not just the message, but, you know, the spirit of the message. Our life, the message of transcendence, is our life is with Krishna. And when you're living your life from the position of whatever I'm doing, Krishna's there, thought of Krishna is there. You'll know everything. How to deal with your dependence. But it sounds like you're doing a really good job. Why is it that we only take that which is offered to Krishna? And when that goes into the heart of the child, they won't accept anything else. I'll just end with this. I had this experience. I was in Bombay and visiting the Chaupati temple, and there were some people that came to see me, and so I had some mahaprasadam from wherever I had been previously. And I wanted first to give to, there was a small boy, and I just, you know, I held it out. And he looked at me. His eyes didn't blink, his hand didn't move, his body language was, said okay, and then gave to everybody else, and everybody else accepted. Then I came back to him and extended it to him, and it was the same response. Like, and then his mother leaned over, said something in his ear, and his hand went out. And I gave him some prasad. And I asked her later, I didn't do it in front of him because I didn't want to embarrass him, I said, what did you say? They said, it was prasadam. Because if it wasn't prasadam, he wasn't going to accept it. Although it was burfi, it was like, you know, it looked good. But if it wasn't prasadam, and he was, you know, little. 4 years old. And they didn't browbeat him saying, you know, something. Scold him, warn him, threaten him, something. They just explained what's the difference. And therefore we take only prasadam. He didn't know. I mean, he knew me, but he didn't know what it was, so he didn't accept it. When that kind of conduct, behavior takes place, that's success. It's not, it's a principle based, from the heart based, I'm not going to involve something unless it's come from Krishna. Okay. We'll end. Thank you. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.